everybody gets that love is a deeply nuanced emotion that looks very different depending on context. We can state that we feel love for our coworkers, our kids, our partners, and perfectly cooked French fries all in the same conversation without anybody getting the wrong idea. Why don't we recognize the same kind of broad diversity possible for anger? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Many of us have been raised to associate rage with loss of control, with violence. We're told that the way to be a better person is to learn to control and ultimately let go of our fury. But that advice assumes anger will always manifest as a kind of self-centered and destructive temper tantrum, when in fact, my guest says it can be deeply righteous, inclusive, and motivating. Maisha Cherry is an assistant professor of philosophy at the University of California, Riverside. Her new book is called The Case for Rage: Why Anger is Essential to Anti-Racist Struggle. Maisha, welcome to Think.
Oh, thank you for having me.
You've been frustrated by your observation that some people seem more troubled by the anger of anti-racists than about racism itself. How has that attitude affected the way anti-racists are able to connect to and act on their rage?
Yeah, I got interested in the topic because of witnessing that behavior. I myself was experiencing anger at the death of Trayvon Martin that took place in 2012. I was seeing people marching the streets with Black Lives Matter, very much angry. And I thought, or the assumption that I had in my mind, is that people would take that anger seriously. I mean, that was naive, but I thought at least people will understand it. But what I saw was that people was assessing or judging the anger as incorrect, as in it's not warranted, as in the way that these activists was expressing their anger was in some way misguided. And so I was very much concerned, as much as I was trying to make sense of the anger that I was feeling, I was very much concerned about the ways that anger is being perceived by others. Now, I want to admit that I'm very much sympathetic to people being concerned or worried about people's anger. Going back to ancient Greek philosophy, the Stoics, Seneca was very much concerned that anger will lead to violence, that anger will lead to war. And there's no doubt that we've been in situations that have made us uncomfortable when we see the anger or the angry expressions of others. But what I'm trying to get people to see is that anger is not always destructive, particularly anger at racism and anger at racial injustice, that if we only listen to the anger of the oppressed or the anger of the marginalized, then we have much to discover, not only about their lived experiences, but also about the things that we value and the democratic idea that we're not living up to, but that we can live up to if only we listen to the anger of others.
Yeah, you write about the idea that anger is a really powerful communication tool if it's wielded properly. We pay attention when someone is really angry.
Yeah, it's communicative. I mean, one might say that a lot of emotions are communicative. I mean, you mentioned love to start this conversation. And I know I've been in situations that I don't necessarily need anyone to tell me that they love me. I can feel it, right? Mm-hmm. It's somehow communicated in one particular sense. But one of the things that I find powerful about anger, and evolutionary biologists suggest that this is one of the things that is powerful about the emotion itself, and perhaps not only in human beings, but also in animals, is that it communicates in very distinct ways from other emotions that something is wrong and the ways in which we're living together. And it's a call. It's a challenge. One might even say that it's a threat, and that threat can be on your face. That threat can be consequential, not necessarily revenge, but it's also a threat and a challenge for wrongdoers that if you don't get yourself together, that there will indeed be consequences. I mean, we've had situations in which, as a child, my mother would say things in a very nice tone, and I would be rebellious. And then when she put anger in her face for some way, some strange reason, it will call me to be attentive to what she has to say. I mean, that's the power of anger. It's communicative in that particular sense. It grabs our attention. But what it communicates is something valuable. It alerts us to a wrongdoing. And it also challenges us to rectify that particular wrongdoing, amongst other things.
And specifically as applied to anti-racist efforts, modern portrayals of Martin Luther King tend to play down his rage, right? We sort of get the shorthand view that Malcolm was angry, Martin was peaceful, as if these concepts are mutually exclusive.
Right. And as if we are the kind of human beings that are mutually exclusive when it comes to emotions in general,
Right,
right? Don't,
right.
so no matter how no matter how much we may have a disposition towards a certain kind of emotion, I mean, I know a lot of people who are very, very calm. If you find them in a unique situation, we're going to find them very different from a calm state. I mean, that's just the reality of human beings. And so I'm very much disturbed by those images, those kind of reductive images of both those particular figures. I mean, you talked about Malcolm X. I'm glad you mentioned him. I mean, the mass media will have us to think that he was always an angry person. But if you look at the interviews, I mean, there's compassion there, there's empathy there's patience there. But when it comes to Martin Luther King, I mean, there's been this sanitized image about who he was. And there's no doubt that he preached a love ethic. There's no doubt that he found something very much in redemptive in love. And I'm very much with that project. But if you go through his writings, he's very articulate about anger, right? He doesn't condemn anger in his writings. The only anger that he condemns is an unexpressed, immature anger, an anger that is challenged and channeled in a wrong direction. So he recommends, according to the image and the life and the exemplar of W. Du Bois in one of his eulogies towards him, for people to model their lives off of W. Du Bois, that be angry and do something constructive with that particular anger. I mean, when we think about the letter from a Birmingham jail, I mean, I've been teaching that in my intro to philosophy courses, pairing that with Credo and Plato and all that good stuff. But one of the things that people don't know about the letter from a Birmingham jail, that it was written out of anger. It was written out of righteous rage. He was very much frustrated with the white moderates telling him to wait when they're supposed to be in solidarity with him. And so he wrote that letter. Very much angry about their response of allies. And we teach that letter. We often go back to that letter. It's a powerful piece of political philosophy, but that arises out of anger. And so if King can be loving, but yet use anger in the right way, then that's a reminder to us that those two things are not mutually exclusive, that you can have anger and love, they are compatible. But that anger can also be an expression of love. And that's one of the things that I find powerful about the emotion.
Okay, we're going to get in a couple of minutes to the form of anger that you think that we can embrace and use in service to anti-racism. But before that, I have to say, I learned so much by your explanation of different forms of rage, which in fact can be toxic. So I want to go through those before we get to Lordian rage. First, what is rogue rage?
I like distinctions. I mean, for those who may be curious about what philosophers do, I mean, we love making distinctions, right? So I'm glad you found that chapter fruitful because I was afraid that I was being too philosophical there. So like you said, yes, ro rogue rage is one of the kind of destructive kinds of anger that I highlight in the book. And I think we've all have witnessed or perhaps even experienced rogue rage before. I mean, we can imagine kind of a typical person who experiences rogue rage would be kind of like the hateful troll. It's a stereotypical image, so it's not exclusive to this particular image, but kind of that angry person who expresses their anger online, right? Is directed usually at scapegoats. It doesn't matter who the real target. If a person feels like an injustice or something that's horribly gone wrong, they don't email letters to the congressman, right? They troll Jews, for example. They troll women, for example. They just hit back on scapegoats. Also, they don't aim for any kind of change whatsoever, right? They just hit back at the world for hitting back at them. The perspective that includes it or the person that they're thinking about is only themselves, so they're not thinking about others. And so you can imagine if the anger has those particular features, then that person is not going to be motivated to do anything about the injustice, to remedy the injustice. They're just going to stay mad, direct their anger on people who don't deserve it, and do destructive as opposed to constructive things.
What you call wipe rage is frankly terrifying. Explain what this is.
Now, people may hear that and think that I'm saying white, as in the color rage, but it is wipe, WIPE. And the reason why I named it that is that, you know, kind of different from rogue rage, that the aim of the anger is to eliminate the other. And primarily, the emotion that informs this kind of anger is a hatred. It's a hatred for others. It's a hatred not for evil, but for other citizens, right? It comes about as a result of othering. And when you have hatred towards other individuals and you aim to eliminate them, right? And so one of the examples that I use as an example of white rage, we can imagine what happened on January the 6th. Right, as we hear people storming the Capitol, kind of the racial epithets that were used, that they were so upset and so angry about what they thought to be an injustice, but they didn't seek to go to Congress to do it in any democratic way, right? They were after lawmakers seeking to express their hatred towards the Democratic Party and get rid of them. Hence, we can hear individuals calling to kind of lynch or to hang Mike Pence, right? So that's the kind of anger. It's destructive in that particular way, because when you have that kind of perspective, when you have hatred kind of undergirding your anger, then that's going to lead one to participate in very destructive activities. I mean, another example, white rage is Charlottesville, what happened in Charlottesville, right? The kind of exclusive language, individuals only thinking about themselves and their particular status, and not necessarily concerned about all individuals and all citizens. And so one of the things I want to say is that, hey, anger is not necessarily bad, but when it has these particular features, such as it's aiming to eliminate others, it's undergirded by hatred, it's not focused on the real target, but only on scapegoats, then we can imagine why people like Seneca would say, get rid of this anger. Replace it with other positive emotions, because once you have these particular types of anger, it's going to lead to destruction for sure.
People who hold what you call resentment rage, different from resentment, and I know you'll explain that for us. They,
I try.
They tend to hate the dominant group, right, but envy it at the same time. And this counterproductively centers the dominant group, doesn't it?
Right. We can imagine. I mean, this is some psychological stuff here of how you can be so angry at a group of people who for oppressing you. But you, if you could turn the tables around, you too desire their power, right? And desire to do the same kinds of things. And there's a variety of ways in which this can manifest. And so one of the things that comes to mind, and I don't think I necessarily mentioned this in the book, is that we can imagine kind of Black nationalists, for example, angry at white supremacy, but uses the kind of power that they have in particular Black communities to kind of oppress Black women, right, as a way to kind of get close to whiteness and its power as possible, right? So we can imagine that particular example. So it doesn't aim for any kind of transformation, right? It's only concerned about switching the hands of power so that one can govern, not judiciously, not in a just manner, but to kind of duplicate the same injustice that they were once a part of.
And then there is narcissistic rage. And this one is interesting because it appears it might be useful in counteracting the forces of racism, but in fact, it stages that fight on an individual basis rather than on behalf of every member of an oppressed group.
Right. It's close to the virtuous kind, right? You're getting there almost, right? So it could be targeted towards racists and racist attitudes, and it could be justifiable and appropriate given the reality of those that particular injustice. One may desire to change the state of affairs, making sure that injustice doesn't happen anymore. But one is really only thinking about oneself. So one perhaps is not attuned to the way that a particular injustice harms other social groups. One just feel that the injustice shouldn't hit them, right? So here's an example. I mean, one of the examples that I used in the book was an airport example of a gentleman. I don't know the cause in which he was arrested, but as he's getting arrested by the police, he's screaming in the airport saying that you're treating me like a Black person. Yeah. Now, one might hear this and thinking that the person is uttering a kind of solidaristic kind of response and saying, hey, in solidarity with Black people, we shouldn't be treated in this particular way. No, right? He believes he's being unfairly treated by the police. But he doesn't take this as a social reality that should be remedied. He believes that he is the exceptions to such treatment. And so he believes that as a result of his particular position in society, then he should not be treated like those Black people, right? So the perspective that informs it is the person wants justice, but only justice for themselves. And so they are absent or ignorant of the larger social context. And when you have this, then you can imagine that person going to court to sue civilly. And so he may get money for the treatment that happened with him and the police. But while at the same time, Black people are still being mistreated by the police in other communities, and his anger is not directed towards them. So it's close there. But because of its narcissism, this focus on oneself, thinking that one is above other individuals that are treated similarly, suggests that there's something fishy and perhaps even vicious about that kind of anger.
All right, Maisha, I want to move on now to the form of rage that you do endorse, the one inspired by Audre Lorde. How do you define Lordean rage?
Well, the way in which I define it is very much inspired by the scholar and feminist Audre Lorde. I remember a few years ago when I first got interested in the topic, I noticed that a lot of philosophers were citing her. And so I was like, oh, who's this Black woman that these white feminist philosophers are citing? And I read her essay, The Uses of Anger. And I was blown away. And so some of the features that I lay out that makes what I'm calling Lordi and Rach name after her different from the other anger that I described before the break, kind of is inspired by that particular essay. So for those who read the essay, some of this stuff should sound familiar. If you haven't read it, please read it, The Uses of Anger. So Lordi and Rach is directed at racism, racist attitudes, racist policies, et cetera. When one has this particular anger, one has a desire to change such state of affairs, to make a racist society less racist. The perspective that informs it, or at least the mindset that a person has when they have this particular anger, is that they understand that they are not free until everyone is free. And so they don't just want justice for themselves, but they want justice for everyone. This person recognizes in the King sense that a threat to justice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. So given the direction of the anger, given the aim of the anger, and given the perspective that informs it, that a person who has this particular anger is more likely, unlike January 6th, unlike Charlottesville, it's more likely to engage in very positive actions to bring about a different world in which all of us, regardless of color, creed, et cetera, can live in a just world. So I say this briefly. I have a worry that you're going to ask me this in more detail. But I think one of the powerful things about Lordi and Rach is that it's able to express value for those who oppress. It's able to motivate us in very unique psychological and cognitive ways to engage in change. It allows us to be what I call kind of a resistant figure by resisting kind of racial rules that says that you should not value certain kinds of lives. And it also, in so many ways, allows us to mix that particular anger with the positive emotions such as compassion, such as love, and very compatible ways to engage in anti-racist struggle.
So you explained that Lordi and Rach works really well as a tool against racism and racist structures. You are adamant, though, throughout the book that Lordi and Rach is not and should not be interpreted as specifically Black rage.
Right.
But talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I think you know, usually when we use the word, the phrase Black rage, referring to simply the rage of Black folks in relationship to racism and racial injustice. One might even say that Lordi and Rach could be a broader category in which Black rage falls under, but I wouldn't necessarily equivocate the two. I believe that one can have Lordi and Rach and not be Black, right? One can have Lordi and Rach and be an Asian American who are just simply upset about the racial violence that is being done to them as a result of their race, right? That's Lordi and Rach. Very different from Black rage, because to have Black rage, one must be Black. It also, it's a kind of rage, and I'm talking about Lordi and Rach here, that you can have in response to one's own oppression, but also a kind of rage that one can have in response to the direct oppression of others. And so while Black rage may fit under the umbrella of Lordi and Rach, I refuse to restrict the kind of anger that I'm talking to or talking about as only anger that is experienced by Black folk. I would think that if you live in a democratic society in which you believe in kind of liberal values of justice and equality for all, that when you witness an injustice, no matter what color you are, no matter what class or creed you are, then you will respond to that injustice with anger, regardless of one's color. And your anger will be directed at racism, and you will have a desire to engage in particular change. And you're not just concerned about yourself, but everyone else. So you don't have to be Black to have that particular feeling. So that's why I think Lordi and Rach is a good distinction to make, although one might say that Black rage may fall under it.
All right, I want to throw in a caveat here. How can non-Black people, and specifically white people, wield Lordi and Rach without stepping over into that tempting danger zone where we take allyship over the line and think of ourselves as the center of the story?
Right. So one of the things I'm very careful with, and one of the things I'm recognizing, I really try to protect the emotions that I defend. People try, as you kind of indicated in the beginning, people pick on anger, and I want to come to anger's defense. But I also want to put some agency on the individual, right? So I say early in the book, and this is connected to your question. I say early in the book, listen, Lordi and Rach is very likely to go right in ways in which white rage, for example, is not. But it could go wrong. And not necessarily because of the anger, but because of we who are experiencing the anger, right? We're flawed. We're human beings who could get riled up and due to other motivations that have nothing to do with lordy and rage can engage in counterproductive or hateful actions. I want to make room for that because I have to make room for the agency of others. And so given that particular perspective, then when it comes to allies in the struggle for racial justice, such as white allies, I also must make room that there can be some mistakes that one can make, even when one is sincere, even when one is sincerely angry at injustice and is fired up, on behalf of the injustice that they are witnessing, that person can engage in certain kinds of mistakes, right? And this mistake is not because they're just overt racists. The mistakes come about, first of all, because we are human and we're just going to mess up no matter what kind of virtues that we possess or desire to wield. But we're also going to mess up because we are, particularly white folks, inherit a white supremacist society. And that comes with certain kinds of assumptions, and that comes with certain kinds of ideas that I think true anti-racists are trying to shield themselves from every day. I mean, I, as a Black person, wake up every day trying to figure out how I can, kind of get rid of the white supremacy ideas and attitudes that I have in my own mind. So I can imagine how that struggle and what that struggle is for white folk. And what can happen as a result of that just because you are anti-racist doesn't mean that there's no way that you can engage in any kind of racist, whether that's overt or implicit or explicit racism, or have certain kinds of attitudes. You're not immune to kind of racial or supremacist attitudes. So here's an example. I had to give a kind of warm up there. An example of how someone can use lordy and rage. And let's talk about white allies who I call rage renegades in the book. So we can imagine that a white ally is angry at injustice, right? Angry at racial injustice and really want to do something about it. And we may have witnessed this. And because they live in a white supremacist society, they may not even be aware of this, that they recognize that when they have particular emotions, that they are listened to more than Black people, right? We know that usually, marginalized folks are usually the individuals that are more likely to be tone policed, that is more likely to be dismissed. People don't listen to, the sadness and the disappointment and the anger of a lot of people of color, for example. This is an unfortunate situation, but a white ally might understand that and kind of use this in kind of unproductive ways, right? So a white ally might think, hey, that their anger matters more than the anger of the oppressed, right? Because when they're angry, podcasters call them up to express their anger, right? Or interviewers interview them and get them to talk about their particular anger, right? And one of the things I want to say is that, hey, even when that happens, right, please be mindful that your anger doesn't matter more because you are white, right? And part of the work of not only just being an ally, but sharing in the anger with other oppressed people is when that happens, when you realize that you may be getting more attention due to your anger more than other oppressed people, that you need to make room or make space for your other people that you're in solidarity with to express themselves, to give voice. So that may include being quiet when a reporter asks you about certain kinds of things, or if you have a podcast, inviting people of color as guests, for example, right? Or step into the back of a protest line or a petition, right? Is basically decentering oneself, right? As you engage in particular allyship. But it can be tempting to make oneself the center when we live in a world in which your life is the center. And so I'm trying to challenge rage renegades that even though you have lordy and rage, be very, very careful that certain kinds of attitudes that you're fighting against doesn't infect your virtuous lordy and rage.
How does lordy and rage allow for what you call tactical diversity and the strategies we can employ to fight racism?
Ah, so as I kind of been echoing, not necessarily explicitly, but also kind of implicitly, and we mentioned this when we talked about love and anger, is that we have a tendency to think that emotions that make us feel good is incompatible with emotions that quote unquote make us feel bad, right? So we talked about how people don't think that anger and love can go together. I think they very much can. And I think typically when we are angry at our children, for example, we are angry at them because we do love them, right? They're very much compatible with each other. And so I think it's the same case when it comes to anger. I think anger is compatible not only with love, but it's also compatible with compassion. It's also compatible with care. It's also compatible with goodwill. But I also would say that one of the things that I find powerful about my argument, if I may say so myself, is that I'm not suggesting that the only emotion that we should feel is anger, right? I'm trying to say, don't give up on anger just too quickly, right?
Don't
replace it too quickly. Because I think there's a lot of tools in our moral and political toolkits that we can put in practice. And I think emotions is a good, it was one of those tools. And so there may be instances in which anger would be just fine to respond to injustice. It's one of those tools. But it may be another instance, as much as I may be angry at a racist, the victim of that racism may need my compassion, right? So I got anger going on towards the wrongdoer. I got compassion going on towards the person who was wrong. And I may have care in response to the community that witnessed that particular injustice. So I have three emotions going on at the same time. I mean, that's the reality of who we are. And as a result of that, I take it to be kind of what mixed martial arts are. Right. As I suggested, no matter what direction injustice comes my way, no matter how injustice hurts or harm a particular society, what emotions is able to do is to respond to each one of those things very distinctively and very different, but respond to it none the least. So I talk about how now I don't do MMA. I did a little research. I talk about that one of the things about mixed martial arts that it allows you to box, you know, so you know how to box when you're standing up, you know how to wrestle, jiu-jitsu when you're down on the ground, you learn how to kick, Muay Thai, whatever position you are. So you have a lot of things on your toolkit depending on what the situation or the particular enemy warrants. And I take the same thing to be the case when it comes to emotion. So we shouldn't just have one emotion in our toolkit to fight injustice. I want us to have a variety of emotions, right? I just don't want us to get rid of anger in the process.
What makes Lordian rage, in your estimation, an inherently optimistic proposition?
Yeah, when you are angry, and neuroscientists will agree with me on this, when you are angry, you have a desire to approach the target or the cause of one's anger. So if I know that my sister stole something from me, anger makes me want to say, hey, where is my stuff? Right? It motivates as an approach, what psychologists will call approach tendency. Not only that, when you are angry, you are very optimistic. You honestly believe that you can change the state of affairs, right? So when I go to my sister and I say, where's my stuff? I honestly believe by approaching her, I can get my stuff back. I mean, anger just creates this optimism. It also increases the risk that we're willing to engage in. So my sister's 2 years older than me. As a kid, I'm willing to risk it all to get my stuff, right? That's just what anger does, right? And we can imagine if you are angry from a racist perspective, that can motivate you in very unproductive ways, right? That you are willing to engage in kind of violent action and risk your freedom in order to kill others, as we just witnessed in the news not too long ago. But when it comes to Lordian rage, I mean, if you are optimistic, if you have this self-belief in yourself and you're willing to approach the object of your anger, then you are willing to engage in productive action, no matter how powerful the forces are. And that is the thing that I think is important to really bring about change. And that's why angry people are people who are change makers. Because the way that anger operates in us as human beings, it makes us confident. It makes us optimistic about the future. And so I don't believe anyone who says that angry people are nihilists. No, they are hopeful. They believe that things can change and they are the people that can change it.
Maisha Cherry is assistant professor of philosophy at the University of California, Riverside, and author of The Case for Rage, Why Anger is Essential to Anti-Racist Struggle. Maisha, thanks very much for spending this time with us. Really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I enjoyed it.
You can like our page on Facebook. On Twitter, our handle is at KERA Think. We do hope you will become a subscriber to the Think podcast. It's free. You just search for KERA Think wherever you get your podcasts. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.